all your logic and argument comes back to is Jews can stay in England. That's always your position. That's all you care about.
It's the canary in the coal mine of your ridiculous philosophy.
No, but all I'm saying is...
Steve Laws is a re-migration activist who advocates for the deportation of non-English people back to their beautiful home countries. And he recently went viral following a heated interview on the Heretics podcast with Andrew Gold.
I think he wasted a lot of time with that interview talking about Jews. He's ethnically Jewish. He's not English. He's trying to adopt our ethnic group so it keeps him safe in the country.
I never really considered myself anything other than English.
You're not good. English, though. You're not good, English. If you're not,
my grandparents were English.
You're not English. But
when people are presenting themselves as English and trying to adopt our identity...
I am a patriot.
They're not doing it because they care about the English. They're doing it because they care about themselves.
It is a love of this country as an open, generous place.
We have our own homeland. We have a right to exist. Other people have their lands. If you present the idea of Israel should be for the Jews, everyone's okay with that.
Are you a Zionist?
Yes.
I am a Zionist.
We stand with Israel.
When you put yourself forward and say, I want England for the English, all of a sudden everyone's like, oh my God, that's shocking.
Ethno-nationalism.
We will fight you with everything we have because you are the enemy.
The English have the rights to this land. Our people have a right to a future. Andrew Gold is crying about pushback from anonymous accounts and young white nationalists who have heard him say that our people are going to go extinct.
At some point, unfortunately, white people will become a minority and will probably go extinct.
And we propose an idea where we prevent that, and he says we're immoral and shouldn't do that, and then cries that people are upset with him.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, a man that everyone seems to be talking about at the moment. Everyone seems to be talking about him, so I thought I would like to talk to him. And that is what should we call him? The independent-based campaigner or something? I don't know what the appropriate title is. Mr. Steve Laws. Steve, hello.
Hello there, mate. Thanks for having me on. Remigration activist, I'd call myself, or a remigration advocate.
A remigration activist. Okay, now that sounds good. Okay, we'll call you that. So the remigration activist, Steve Laws. So tell me, how did you get? How did you go from being a chap living in Kent to 6 years ago, relatively suddenly emerging onto the scene? How did that happen?
So. It's from where I'm at now was very different to where I was at 6 years ago. So I used to just film the illegal immigrants that used to come over on the boat. So I was one of the first to do so, sort of every day, go to Dover, which was the town over from me, hop on the train in the morning, film all the illegals coming over, put them onto social media. And I'd do that continuously every day for like, it must have been about 3 or 4 years continuously, give or take the odd day. And then as time went on, I moved forward to campaigning on, against immigration, and then obviously the obvious solution is remigration. So that's where I'm at now, campaigning on total remigration. It's been quite a journey, but
how did you get into the journey in the first place? Why did you? At what point did you do something? How old were you when you decided that something snapped in you and you decided I'm going to go and start filming illegal immigrants at Dover?
It's quite silly, really. I was having a discussion with my friends and I was like, these illegals are coming over on boats. They're getting picked up on coaches and getting taken straight to hotels. He didn't believe me. So on my lunch break at work, just to prove a point to a friend, I went down, filmed it, showed what was happening. He was like, oh, this is clearly happening. And then I uploaded it on Twitter because he was shocked that it was happening. So I was like, oh, maybe others don't know it. I had like a small account with like maybe 50 to 100 followers. And then that blew up. It got like 1 million views even from that size account. And I was like, oh, maybe people don't know about this, which encouraged me to go and film a few more days. And then as time went on, I kind of just got sort of obsessed with it to an extent, just wanted to keep finding out more information. And it just sort of snowballed from there, really. But there was no real like spark, like I've got to go and do something. It was more just to prove a point to my friend.
I see. And according to Hope Not Hate, they sent a dossier of your activities and you lost your job over this eventually.
I've lost a few jobs over this over the years, but it's just part of the activism, unfortunately. Once upon a time I was working for the council. That was obviously not going to last very long when you're doing this sort of activism. And then I've had roles such as working at Saga. Here's the funny thing, all of these people that report my job losses also like report on the wrong companies and stuff like this, so wherever they're getting their information from is ridiculous. But yeah, I have lost jobs over the years. It's not ideal, but it is what it is, to be honest.
Why is it though? One of the things that I wasn't able to say is that he's from a particular political party or he's from a particular organisation. You seem to sort of move through quite a lot of what Hope Not Hate would call far right organisations. They list it on your little entry on the, well, it's quite a big entry on their website. Why is that? You seem to move through these different groups and never stick with anything.
So here's the thing. When I was with UKIP, I was invited into UKIP. I wasn't really involved in party politics or anything like that. Ben Walker asked me to join the party, asked me to stand. I sort of went in half-hearted and was like, okay, this could push further for illegal immigration. Let's do this. It'll help the campaign. And then I was made immigration spokesman at UKIP, but I was not allowed to like change any of the immigration policy, not have any influence on the direction of the party's immigration view. So I left UKIP, and then from there I joined Reform. But that was another thing where I was invited by Richard Tice and his team to stand, and they wanted sort of the radical base, because back then I wasn't seen as the big far right Nazi, but everyone seems to think of me now. I was more just like a centre right type activist,
friendly neighbourhood Nazi.
Not too high level. So they was okay with that, and they brought me in, and then I got kicked out of that for saying Rishi Sunak was an Indian. And then after I was going to stand in that last general election anyway, and I was going to stand as an independent. And then Mark Collette reached out to me and he said, English Democrats are standing loads of independents under their name. They will pay your deposit and help you with your campaign. Are you interested? To me, it seems like a no-brainer. Rather than standing on my own name, I'd have support with me. So that's it. I never actually really joined the English Democrats. I just sort of stood with them and then parted ways. And then Homelands came along, and then I went to their conference. I was asked to speak. I think you've met a few of the guys as well. I was impressed with what I see. I thought, right, this is a party that could build for the future. I put everything into it. Put my name, my face, my time, even my own money. Like, everything was into it. And then the leadership changed the direction of the party. We had a big fallout. And now I'm stepping away from party politics, and I'm just focusing on activism. And that's where I'm at now, basically. So it wasn't intentional to go. Yeah, sorry. It wasn't intentional to go through these parties, but it ultimately ended up that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that, if I remember rightly, I was going to interview you in, when was it now? May or something? In a studio with Kenny. Both of you.
Yeah.
And then you left the party like literally a week or so before this was supposed to take place. Yes. Okay. So you seem to go through these various organizations. And the key thing that you're now known for is remigration. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we look into this, then it seems that, what remigration are you talking about? I could say, I personally think the 2nd of May, 1997, was the beginning of the Great Treason. And I think it's perfectly reasonable that anyone that has come to the country since the 2nd of May, 1997, unless they have married a Brit or whatever, we should seriously or descended from a Brit, we should seriously question why they need to be in the country at all. I see that as a line to draw. Other people would draw it earlier, perhaps others later. But the consequences, according to... if you ask a chat GPT or whatever, of mass remigration of almost any kind, seem to be that they're likely to be disastrous. 20% of the workforce are foreign-born, 25% of the NHS are foreign, literally foreign, not like ethnic minorities. 40% of the doctors are foreign. And so if anything like this happened, it would cause economic collapse. And presumably it would be like when Queen Mary burnt the Protestants. You know, she went in and said, okay, I'm going to make England Catholic again. And she was so fervent about it that people thought it was rather unfair and going too far and turned against her. I mean, literally her policy to re-Catholicify England caused a huge backlash, and for it to make things worse from her perspective, caused the country to become Protestant. I mean, wouldn't this kind of policy of mass remigration in this way, A, cause economic collapse, B, cause a huge feeling of unfairness and whatever, C, mean that you'd have to institute basically a police state? And so wouldn't this mean that people would react against it and it would make things even worse?
So no, this is something that's always thrown at me, but I've never really given the opportunity to push back on. is that ultimately this isn't going to be carried out all in one sweep. This isn't a process of we're going to deport 10, 15 million people in one go, and then that's happening overnight. That's not how this would happen. It would be in stages. The first priority would start big campaigns to train our own in the key roles that we need to replace. Obviously, we'd have the data in place to know where we'd need to train our people. We'd prioritise that. We'd put incentives in place for our people to move into those roles. That's something that you'd start from day one before you even start deporting people. From there, you would remove incentives for foreigners so they would leave on their own. That starts getting the ball rolling. When I say incentives, I mean things like removing social housing, universal credit, free access to the NHS, free education. You remove these incentives, that starts making this place very undesirable for people here that don't have money. And then you start going down the process of going, right, we're going to deport the illegals. So that's around 700,000 to 2 million. The figures on it are very sketchy, so it could be anything in that ballpark. And then you start deporting the 10,000 foreign criminals in the current system, and then the foreigners that have served their time. So that's around 30 to 50,000 or so. Once you've gone through those early stages, people get comfortable with deportations. They don't see it as this big, bad thing that's being dragged straight through.
The idea is to kind of Blairism in reverse. So in the way that Blair, he wanted to come in and radically change the country, which he did, but he didn't do it overnight. He did it over a period of 10 years in power, and then the subsequent system that he set up meant that it was impossible to overturn, and difficult to overturn, so it just continued. So the idea is to very, very slowly institute these policies.
How
do you avoid then a government taking power and reversing the policies?
Well, this is the thing. You have to do it in a 5-year term, ultimately, at least the first few stages to get the ball rolling. That would have to be done. So you'd have to deport the illegals, the foreign criminals. You'd have to start working on the Boris wave. You'd have to start targeting immigrants that are not working, making it undesirable for them to be here. Once those incentives are put in place, the public are not going to want to put those incentives back there. They understand the problem of why this caused these problems. So over a gradualized timescale, yeah, you could say 5-10 years. It all depends on how popular you are as a government when this opportunity comes. Obviously, we're all speculating at the moment. None of us have power, so we're just putting our ideas forward. But ultimately, if we was in a position of power and we was carrying out this process, it wouldn't be done in a quick shock and awe process, because the public will push back on that naturally, because anything that's done in shock and awe, regardless of what it is, scares the public and they sort of resist against it. So you do it gradually, you go through stages, and eventually after 5 to 10 years, maybe 15 years, the process is reversed enough that our demographics are secure. And if the public still have the appetite, that's when you can go down the argument of, right, we're having total remigration. Instead of having 95% white British, we're going to go for 99%, 100%. That's how you can get to those stages. But I'm not suggesting that we're going to click our fingers and it's going to be done overnight, because that's ridiculous. That's not how it's going to happen.
It would have to be done slowly, or you would get a collapse in the economy, you would get huge unemployment, you'd get civil unrest, you'd get Scotland breaking away, probably, even though that's hugely white. You'd get international sanctions, and it would reverse. So how would you do it? How are you? I mean, I know it's a really glib question, but how are you defining a British person for the purposes of these policies?
By ethnicity. So English, Scottish, Welsh, they are the British people. If you have that ethnicity, and I'm not saying just having 20% of it. You can do the grandparent approach. So you have two grandparents that are British, like great grandparents that are British, and pass it down the line. There is a number of routes. I'm not saying. And here's the thing that people always throw at me. They're like, Steve, you're saying this, you're saying this. I'm opening the conversation. I'm pushing forward ideas and proposing that these people don't belong in our country. This is clear as day. These are foreigners in our lands. We are being demographically replaced. I'm putting forward suggestions, and I'm suggesting, from my position, I would suggest that you need at least three grandparents that are English, Scottish or Welsh to have a claim to this land.
So that would have to come at a certain a point that you'd then have to define.
Then you'd have to go down a time scale. You'd have to draw a line in the sand. Of course, all of these options do come. They come. There's nuance to it as well. I'm not suggesting I have all of the answers. All I'm suggesting is that this conversation needs to be pushed forward. Politicians need to put policies in place that prevent our people from being demographically replaced in our homelands. And And the reason everyone is gravitating towards the total remigration position at the moment is because at least I've defined who can and can't stay. Everyone else who's critiquing me hasn't drawn a line in the sand. They haven't said, right, this is where we want to be at. I've said I want total remigration gone, total remigration, I want all of the foreigners gone. Everyone else who's critiquing me hasn't put a percentage on it. They haven't drawn a line in the sand.
The question of why is interesting, because in 1999, when Nick Griffin took over the British National Party, the party had a policy of compulsory repatriation. That was the word they used then, repatriation. In 1999, when he became leader, the party kind of liberalised and dropped that policy. That policy, the idea of repatriating non-British people, ethnic non-British people, was so appalling, even to the kind of people that would vote BNP, that they dropped that policy, and now that policy is back on the table, and presumably that's what why do you think that policy is now back?
Because our people are under threat. The people could, like, if you go back 30 years and you're raving about demographic replacement and we're still 94% of the population, the people look at you and go, what are you talking about? But now people are looking at the population, and I would argue around 65% now. When that next census comes, it's going to shock a lot of people, I think. But I would argue around 65 to 67% of the population. So now our argument of we're being demographically replaced holds a hell of a lot of weight. It didn't 30 years ago. Now it does. That's where the change is at. And there's also the line that nationalists before would always take the approach of, we're going to meet in the middle. We're going to moderate our approach. We're going to almost subvert the system, so to speak. And we're going to try and get our foot in that way. That's never worked. It's never worked ever for nationalism. Now nationalists are putting their flag in the grounds and they're saying, we do not want to be replaced. We want total remigration. We want these people sent back. And they're not moving from it. And that's the argument. That's where most of the youth are at. They just want them all gone. And that's how this conversation is evolving. It's to the point where they're even talking about it on GB News now. All of these podcasters are freaking out about it. The centre-right are in meltdown over it. And that's because we've just held ground on, and we're not budging in. And the BNP, obviously,
sorry.
I was just going to say, and the BNP, obviously, from 30 years ago, was in a very different political landscape than we are now. So we have that benefit in favour.
Yes, the wokeness was pushed so far, particularly, I think, with the transsexual issue, that it was forcing people to say that black was white. And that's what's tipped people over. It's just ridiculous to have to be told by law that you must participate in some man's sexual fantasy or be punished. Is quite extraordinary, another problem is that the ethnic minorities have been in the country so long that a lot of people a small number of people have interbred with them. So you have then people who are what they used to say half caste. Well, I don't know what we're supposed to call them these days, mixed race or something, I suppose. And you have generations of such people, and then you have people that have who are perfectly based and right wing and red pilled, who have friends who are ethnic minorities in English people, British in living in Britain, ethnic minority. I know I do. You even have ethnic minorities that are active in active in, you know, based anti woke whatever kind of circles, and it often quite senior. I mean, if in the case of the, you know, the chap in Reform or whatever, in these circles. So how does that kind of work in terms of the
reason? Well, here's the thing. For one, these people are victims of immigration. Like their entire situation that they've been put in is because immigration was forced against our people, against our will, and they've been products of that. Unfortunately, that does happen. And I take quite the hard line on this because I want to keep the conversation moving forward. And my approach is that unless you're if you're non-European and mixed race, I think you should go back. If you're European and mixed, if you're European and mixed, that's fine. But if you're mixed race in terms of you're non-European and you are, say, you've got an English father and a Jamaican dad, then that to me is problematic. And I would offer your whole family to leave. That's something that I would offer. Because here's the thing.
This person is just as much Jamaican as they are ethnically British.
Yes, you could argue that. So why not there and why here and why not there?
Well,
if they're just as Jamaican as they are English. Here's the thing. This is just down to, then it comes down to emotion and morality. whether you're okay with sending those people back or not. Personally, I am. Some people would not be. But ultimately, mixed race people have an inherent bias towards their non-white, to their non-white identity. You look at people like Bob Villain. Is it Bob Villain? The How Do You Want Your Country Back fella? He's a mixed race fella. He's on stage laughing at other people saying you're not getting your country back. He's half English. Does he see himself as English? No, he's saying you're not getting your country back, and he identifies with his foreign side. Of course, I'm not saying every mixed race person's like that, but an awful lot that I've come across have had that attitude, especially when you look back to like the BLM riots and all of that going on. Every mixed race person identified with their BLM side. So there is the argument that these people, whilst yes, they are part of us, they are still an other group. And that's how I see them.
What do you think of the argument that if we say that, if we try to understand the borders of Britishness or Englishness, then we say, well, the English are an extended genetic family, right? We have common ancestors. We're all of us on average descended from Edward III. On average, two native English people are 12th cousins. It may well be that you and I are 12th cousins. We could be closer. But that's the average. And so that's why it's a genetic family. And in terms of genetics and in terms of evolutionary interests, you know, genes passing on indirectly, that's why people sacrifice their lives in war, you know, that works. That's fine. But equally, an element of what you see as your family is also emotion. And people can adopt people into their family. And we might even say that some ethnic minorities have sort of earned being admitted into the family circle. When I was a kid, I'm probably quite a bit older than you, you won't remember, but when I was a kid, you'd have people, in old men in pubs, they'd say, oh, send them all back, didn't they? Send them all back. I'd go, yeah, send them all back, yeah. Except Frank. Oh, yeah, except Frank. Yeah, Frank's one of us. Frank Bruno. Because he'd been born in Britain anyway, but B, you know, he was our boxing champion, and he was you know, we kind of felt that he'd earned the right to stay. The rest of them could get out, but this person had contributed enough that he could stay. And perhaps there are many instances like that where an emotional attachment overcomes a genetic factor. If you think about the fact that, like, you're genetically closer to your cousin than you are to your dog, but who do you love more? Probably your dog, unless you're a Muslim or something.
Here's the thing,
and so
I was just going to say,
what do you think of that?
Here's the thing, ultimately. There are people that have the situation where, yeah, I've got that nice foreign friend and they want to make the exception. But going back to when you was a child, I don't know how old you are, so I'm just going to assume and say 30, 40 years ago. It was a very different time. There was the odd one or two nice immigrants. Now there's a million nice immigrants. Where do you draw the line? Here's the thing. So there's a million nice Frank Brunos walking around now. Are we going to keep every single one just because everyone's got a friend who's foreign? Like, that's ridiculous. You can't make policy on emotion, because if you make policy on emotion, you're asking for an ultimate crumble of your ideas. Because when you start making exceptions, here's the thing that winds me up as well. Like, our guys at the moment are trying to make exceptions now, before we're even in a position to bargain. It doesn't make any sense. Like, everyone's going, oh, we should make this exception, this exception, this exception. So by the time we even get to a position where we can make exceptions, we've already made so many allowances, we'd have to make more to get over the line. And I think people shouldn't be doing that right now. I think the position we should be holding right now is the hardest line possible to drag everyone to our position.
I don't know if you, I would say that Tony Blair is one of the, I despise everything he stands for, but he's a political genius, and he changed the country in a way that I find appalling and I want to reverse. But how did he do it? He did it exactly the opposite. You don't talk about the ultimate goal, which is a completely British Britain. No way. You don't even talk about it. Not publicly. You slowly do things. You don't state the ultimate goal. You don't tell people what you actually want to do, which is destroy Britain and make it into a multicultural hellhole, so that the left are in power forever. You don't do that. You don't say that in public. You're saying the quiet part out loud.
I would argue the opposite, because the public are never going to move to our position until someone presents that position to them and says, it's okay to say this, it's okay to hold these views, it's okay to say this in public and be at this position. Nobody else is saying this at the moment. Until myself and a few others started speaking out like this. Obviously, there's people that have said it in the past, but over recent years, where everyone, all of the wokeries come through, everyone's sort of lost jobs, they're scared what they can say and what they can't say. We've got, our people have been sort of brainwashed and dragged through a system where they need to be shocked out of it before you can even enter the idea of taking these steps to achieving our goals. People need to be completely snapped out of the idea that anyone can be British and everyone can come to the world as long as they're nice and as long as they work hard, they can come here. That entire mindset needs to be shattered. So the whole culture around that needs to change before we can even implement anything on a power level. This is where we're at. We've fallen so far behind that we have to do so much quickly, because we're obviously on a time scale, to drag our people forward. So the shock and awe approach is the most effective approach. If you can tell me another approach that wakes our people up quicker and opens this conversation, by all means, I'm all ears. But as it stands, the only way I can see our people having this conversation is the shock and awe and forcing it in their face.
Right, so then you're saying don't be like Tony Blair, be more like Donald Trump. Just say absolutely outrageous things. Say things that are even more extreme than you would ever even do.
Two-time president, and it clearly works.
Yes, I suppose perhaps it did. Yes, but then what that leads to is something that we didn't have under Tony Blair at all, which is huge social conflict, polarization, the potential for war. And everyone's discussing the possibility of civil war without understanding just how disastrous that would be.
That was the topic of conversation last summer.
Yeah. We've moved on, have we?
Yeah, this is my point. So these conversations are already happening to an extent. There are people taking the radical stance. When something bad happens, the radicals are the ones everyone's turning to for their opinions and their ideas and their solutions. They're not running to the center right for answers. Anytime something major happens, all of the people on the far right, all of our accounts just go, everyone wants to hear what we have to say on the situation. They don't want to hear the soft, moderate, let's all be peaceful, let's all get along. Everyone wants to hear, no, we want them out of our country. We want a solution to this. Here's a solution. This is what people want to hear. So the change in direction is happening. Obviously, It's a slow process and it's going to take a long time to get people there, but it is happening. The mindset is changing, and that's something most people can feel around them. When I started doing my activism, people couldn't even say illegal immigrant on camera, let alone talk about deporting illegals and legals and remigration and so forth. Like, the media was terrified to even say illegal immigration. Podcasters and stuff would call them migrants or refugees and stuff. I've seen the whole process of the narrative and the rhetoric changing over time. And we are going in the right direction.
Presumably, you'd have to set up a sort of a system of tiers of Britishness based on ancestry. And you'd have to have some sort of opt-in on the census or something, I don't know, of a DNA test. And then each person would have to be assessed according to a certain cutoff point with regard to how British they were. Now, And you'd have to go back very far then, wouldn't you? I mean, you've had, even before 1948, you'd have Jewish people in this country, or you've had small numbers of Muslims in this country. You'd have to go back very, very far.
Here's the thing, though, but to do that, we're not talking about having to do that to 10 to 15 million people. That would be when you reach the point of mandatory deportation. The earlier stages are clear as day. We know who the illegals are. We know who the foreign criminals are. We know who the Boris Wave is. We know who the recent arrivals are. We know the immigrants that aren't working and so forth. Those are easy stages to achieve. That's something that's going to remove a lot of numbers as well. And then you combine that with the removal of the incentive. So no schools, no NHS, no free social housing, no universal credit or PIP or whatever else they get. None of that. Take all of that away, combine that with the strict deportation policies and the closed border. And naturally, those processes do an awful lot of the work early on. And it's not even extreme. We can do all that under the current system as it is.
Well, if someone like Andrew Gold, whose show you were on, who is Jewish, says, I don't want to go home. Home. This country is my home. I'm from Britain. My grandfather, grandfather, great grandfather, even great great grandfather, possibly. Ultimately, there would come a point where if he didn't, someone like that didn't cooperate, someone who has only known Britain, and that's also the case of his ancestors going back quite a few generations, you'd kick him out.
Yeah, it's no different than their ancestors never knew any land before they came here, never knew our land before they came here. It makes no difference. They came here, they started a life, they was fine. Their family, their children grew up, they was fine. Why can't that happen in another land for them? Why is it so abhorrent for us to suggest the idea that, I think I've crashed.
Well, I can still hear you.
Oh, you can still hear me. Yeah, so ultimately, I don't understand why people use the argument that it's so cruel to send people to a land they've never been to when they did that anyway coming here.
So you recently, and it's really blown up, went on the show of sort of a friend of mine, I suppose, called Andrew Gold. And this is very much gone viral. He's been on GB News talking about it and saying how sort of extreme he thinks you are and so on. So what are your thoughts on that interview with Andrew Gold on Heretics?
Well, he invited me on. Fair play to him. He invited me on. He reached out after I had the Liam Tufts interview. He said, "Do you want to come on?" I said, "Yeah, sure, by all means." Went on there, did the podcast and stuff. I did think he was a bit dishonest, adding fact checks and at the start of his before the podcast even went out, he asked for a monologue, trying to like paint a picture of me before I'd even given the opportunity for people to see the interview. So I thought that was a bit bad faith because he's not done that on any of his other previous podcasts. So I thought that was a bit out of character and didn't really give me a fair shot. But it is what it is, to be fair. It's his platform. He can run it how he likes at the end of the day. The backlash of it, people went a bit crazy on it, on the backlash. All over Twitter, it was like trending for like 2 or 3 days. It was quite, I'd say it was quite great to see that the support base. Like, I looked at all the comments underneath the interview from Andrew Gold. The majority of people agreed with my position, even if they say, "Oh, I wouldn't go quite as far as Steve, but I can understand where he's coming from," and so forth. I think Andrew really bit himself, sort of shot himself in the foot when he said about the whites going extinct and then said that the position to prevent that from going extinct is immoral. That kind of shot himself in the foot and obviously painted a picture of him in a negative light. Also going on about Jews so much, it's not even something like that I really like go on about. You follow me on X, it's not something that I'd regularly overly go on about. But if I'm asked about it, I'll give my honest view. I think he wasted a lot of time with that interview talking about Jews when we could have spoke about other stuff. That's pretty much my take on it.
One of the things he noticed, he said that your leg shook when you discussed the issue. What's this about?
Well, when I sit in podcasts, like I'm not like one of the most comfortable in front of the camera. So I sort of like fidget a little bit. If I'm one of those, I need something in my hand or I'll fidget my leg or something like that. And it's just what I do. He pointed it out and made out like it was a case of I only do it when I talk about Jews, try and paint a picture of me. But if you rewatch the podcast back, you can see me doing it at various different stages. It's just something I do. I'm one of those who fidgets about high metabolism. I just thought it was a bit of a stupid thing to even point out, to be honest. But it is what it is.
One of the things that he accuses, he used this term in a recent GB News interview about you. He talks about the idea of the woke right. What do you understand the woke right to mean?
So I think they mean anyone who talks about identity and things like that. I think that's the approach. So they say whether you're on the far left and you talk about a trans identity or whether you're on the far right and you talk about an ethnic identity. Comparing the two is completely illogical anyway, because one exists and one doesn't. But that's the line they seem to be using. But the majority of people that are pushing that sort of rhetoric are people like Kizin and Andrew Gold and stuff. And like, no one really cares what they call us at the end of the day. Like, we know what we stand for. We're nationalists. You can call us woke right all you want, but that line's not really going to stick because the public look at it and they think of woke and they think of degenerates and these leftists that want to trans kids and so forth. They don't look at woke and think, oh, it's the bloke who wants to get rid of all the immigrants. So whatever they want to call us is fine by me. It doesn't bother me, but it just seems like a bit of an illogical term.
Well, what he's saying is that there is a degree to which a person such as him, who is ethnically Jewish, can be civically English, and that most people by English would include someone like him in that rubric, that they would say he's an English Jew. Can you be an English Jew if you've been here many generations?
No, he's an ethnic Jew. That's what he is. He's ethnically Jewish. He's not English. He's trying to adopt our ethnic group so it keeps him safe in the country. That's all it is. The majority of the interview of Andrew Gold was just him presenting situations that keep him and his people in our country. That was his only interest. He wasn't bothered about keeping other foreign groups in the country, really. He was only interested in keeping his own group. And of course, everyone has self-interest. I've got self-interest for my people. But the fact remains is, he is not ethnically an Englishman.
No, I suppose there's quite a lot of people now in England, if they have surnames like O'Brien, that are not ethnically English. And people tend to sexually select for similarity. I know of a couple. Have you frozen again?
There we go. Okay. Back in.
All right. So what we're saying, you're saying that Andrew Gold is merely looking out for his own people. I mean, I suppose you could argue, yeah, one of the things they said on GB News was that, you're taking the world back to sort of 1066 or something like that with your definition of English. But even if you go back to the 50s, people would talk about the English in quite mainstream books as an ethnic group, as a Germanic ethnic group that was related to the most closely to other Germanic ethnic groups. And this is a genetic fact. And this is also a historical fact. That's how I remember reading a book some years ago from the mid 50s on the English. And it's quite clear the English are an ethnic group. That was what was widely believed, was mainstream at the time.
Well, this is the thing. And like, here's the argument. Like, a lot of people are complaining that everyone's like planting their flag on ethnicity and so forth. But in times gone by, we never really had to define who we are because we wasn't under threat. Everyone just sort of assumed an Englishman. Everyone looked around, everyone had the mutual understanding of who we are and what we were as a people. Now, when we're under threat and the demographics are declining, everyone wants to plant the flag in the sand and say, this is what we are, this is who we are, and we're under threat. And that's why these arguments of woke right are coming up and so forth. And I don't think it's woke to present your identity. I think like our ethnic group has a right to exist. We don't think here's the thing as well. Like, everyone calls me like a white supremacist. Like, I don't think I'm better than anyone else. I don't think our ethnic group are more like better people. I just think we have our own homeland. We have a right to exist. Other people have their lands and they can return to their lands. I don't see how that's even like a problematic stance to take. It's the natural position that all of our ancestors held from times gone by. But now, when you put yourself forward and say, I want England for the English, all of a sudden everyone's like, oh my God, that's shocking. But if you present the idea of Israel should be for the Jews, everyone's okay with that. But
one of the arguments he put forth is that the way that you are defining Englishness exclusively by immutable characteristics, i.e. the genetics. And I found this quite interesting because a lot of the reason why the shift against woke has occurred, I think, is, as I said to you earlier, is because of the transsexual issue. And what that involves is accepting that there are immutable characteristics that relate to an identity or to an element of self, i.e. your sex, that you cannot change. You cannot change sex. And it's as though the very people that are saying, oh, you cannot change sex, sex is immutable, but they will not accept the same thing with regard to a genetic definition, i.e. you cannot change your gene. If Englishness it relates to, and it does, a genetic cluster, it does. It is a genetic cluster that is different from the French genetic cluster. It's modal differences in genotypic frequencies, which are caused by endogamy and environment. Then you can't change that. That can't be changed. You can't become French if you're genetically English. You can't become English if you're genetically Romanian. It's impossible. And it's almost as though they are defining it, I think, in the same way that transsexuals are defining sex.
Yeah, this is exactly what it is. A man can't become a woman. An African can't become an Englishman. It's just as simple as that. Like, and people do get emotional about the topic because it does mean that some people are going to be seen as outsiders. And that obviously scares some people if they are the outsider. So then they will naturally fight against that position. But at the end of the day, the English have the rights to this land. Our people have a right to a future. And there are going to be people that get caught up in the crossfire when remigration begins. Of course, somebody.
Are you ready for the future of the West?
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.